Let's start with prototype-based languages. So what we're going to do today is we're going to leave the field of those rich type languages with this very prominent split between the concept of classes and the concept of instances of classes. We're going to instead talk about a language that concentrates on mainly just one feature, which would be this delegation or propagating or dispatching queries to prototypes. So for that, we're going to pick a random language. Well, not so random as I have prepared one on the slides, but going to pick one and talk about the basic language features, which are not so many, and especially on how you will have what facilities you have to structure your data, which is basically also just one. And then we're going to concentrate on how to perform something like these code reusage concepts that we have heard for the last few weeks. Also how you can do kind of an imitation of what object orientation provides you, and all of that just with the very basic features of the language. And the general concept of that language is, well, of course, it's a little bit over the top, but yeah, the basic thing that keeps you going for these languages, why should I bother with so much of this precise typing and this nasty type checking and all that, if I just want to have something that I want to hack quick and dirty and don't care too much about that a few weeks later on. And so it's kind of something like rapid prototyping. So what's the matter with types and all that? Well, me personally, I like types quite much, but there's a few issues that people bring up which consider types as being bothersome, especially if you already know what you want. It's quite a small thing, and you want to create an object and just interact with that object all the time, and it acts kind of like a singleton. It feels quite ridiculous to just have to create kind of a template for instances of that class if you only gonna use one at the most in any time. So specifying types for singletons feels kind of ridiculous a little bit, at least. Well, people think so. Getting generic types right in spite of co and contra variants, well, that's also something that you buy yourself into if you trying to get your typing correct and without those dangerous things like casting. So that is something that's quite bothersome. So you might wonder why you would like to have such types anyway if you do casting, if you end up with casting in the end anyway. So why bother with that? And the question is, what could you do with instead of this very strictly typed things? Well, there's the idea of having these prototype-based programming things where you kind of start with implementing, creating examples for how you want to use your entities in your program, and only start off with very basic concepts of what you can do with your entities, and introduce the complexity that you actually need only by need. If you don't have any need for something like polymorphic calls or multiple inheritance or anything, you just don't provide any infrastructure for that, and just do with the very simple mechanics that you have there. So you can kind of shape the features of the language that you use yourself. So that's kind of the pro things for prototypes. Well, at least that's what I've read about that. So let's have a look at one of those. And the one that we are looking at will be, that we'll be looking at is, in this case, Lua. So it's just one of the many languages that do with prototype-based programming. So is there any Lua programmers around? No one? Usually people from these gaming engineering direction know this thing from configuring their gaming engines, but it seems that Lua is not so popular anymore in these kinds of things. Well, anyway, any other prototype-based languages in your favor out there?
JavaScript.
Yeah, JavaScript is one of the prominent prototype-based things. Any other? Okay, so well, it differs a little bit from year to year. It changes, so it's quite interesting to see what people actually do in these days. So let's start with basic features. What are the things that we'll be working with? So yeah, the basic things that you see is chunk. So chunk is just a sequence of statements. So you're kind of used to something like that in these C-like blocks, or Java, you also have these blocks that are always within these curly brackets. Here it's just sequences of statements, and you implicitly declare variables and define them in the same statement. So you can do that in the usual way, like here, where you introduce just a variable s, and you initialize it with zero. You don't have to provide a separator. You can just do without, just putting I becomes one there. Whereas comments, and of course it's something different than the things that you are used to. You have to put two dashes there. You can even put several of them in the same line. The compiler just doesn't care, tries to find out what you meant. And in case it's unique, then you're lucky and the compiler won't complain. Also, there's things like these multi-line comments where I have problems with highlighting them. Then, yeah, you can also just redefine variables that you have already seen. So far, nothing too spectacular, just a little bit more relaxed than you're maybe used to. Yeah. A little bit about types. I said that types would be not as strict as you are used to. So what can you expect from that? Well, you can expect something like that. Well, in that case, it's just another type. True, it's a Boolean. And you can query the variables for the runtime type that they actually carry. So there's nothing like a compile time type, so no static typing, it's just dynamic typing. So you can ask for what the type of A actually is, and you'll end up with Boolean in that case. You can also ask for the type of something like that, which interestingly will be a number. Yeah, well, we're laughing here, but that's because we are kind of used to that Java-like concatenation of strings, which is, well, if you go in other languages, it's not that that prominent anymore. It's not always the plus which does the concatenation in these languages. Yeah.
What I find interesting is that they implicitly pass the
body to the
parameter.
Yeah. there's the operator that we were looking for, which is this string. So it's kind of this operator driven. Depending on what the operator is specified on, the parameters will be casted, and if everything just fails, it will just turn everything to nil. So, yeah. Yeah, you might wonder what type type actually has. So that's kind of an internal function, so it will yield function as type. Then I've talked about the existence of something like a nil, which is kind of the last resort of everything, where if nothing else works, then nil is always the value that you're going with. So you might wonder what the type of nil is, and, well, seems that types of nil is some very unique thing, which is also nil. Language is advertised with support for tagged things like HTML or any other of these tagged things, and you can put them in even as a multi-line thing, and this will just be a string for the system. And then the crucial aspect of this dynamic typing thing is, well, you see, we already have used sometime before, and we can just reuse it and assign a different value to A, and turns out that the return value of the type function now is changed, although it's still on the same A. So that is the crucial thing about these dynamically typed things. You don't have to have a constant static compile time type. That's just runtime types, and you can just fill around with them and change them as you want to have them. So, functions. Functions are kind of first-class citizens in Lua, in the sense that they are not so different from variables as you might think. So you can define a function in a kind of familiar way. You start with a keyword function, and then you use identifier pretty print in that case, and it has several parameters, and as we don't have any static types, we don't need to use them. So it's just names that bind to the parameters, and yeah, throughout the actual body of said function, we can then refer to these identifiers, and they will be used at these points. So much for that. And you end a function with just your end keyword. Apart from that, you can handle these functions as you handle any other value. So you can assign the value of prettyPrint to variable A, which will make A a perfectly fine container for or reference to a function, and we can then perform a function call on the variable A. Although I might have, for example, used A as a container for some number beforehand or something, that just doesn't matter. Now I can call the whole thing as a function. And also I can reassign the original function with something different. And you see here, you see here that I have used the inline function version. So what I've done here is I've rewritten kind of the same function as I had before, just in a different syntactic way. So all that the function definition from above does is just it creates a variable prettyPrint and puts this enormous function, the black one, in there. Okay, I didn't use any of these things, but it doesn't matter too much. And the old function is still accessible via A, of course, because that is untouched by that. So these are the two ways of declaring functions, and you can handle them as kind of like pointers, but not with pointer arithmetic, so more like with references. Good. That's still not that difficult. Now let's talk about how you can introduce something like structure in your data. And turns out that there's just one complex data type available, nothing else, and that is a table. You can index in such a table via any arbitrary value. The only value that's not allowed is nil. If you try to index with nil as value, you'll get a runtime error. Okay. Those buggers are also arbitrarily large, so there's at least only implementation impended bounds on how large these structures will actually become, and they can be dynamically growing and shrinking, and that's just not predefined how they have to work internally. So it's implementation dependent whether they actually do shrink or not in terms of memory consumption or anything. That just doesn't isn't defined. But in a kind of a user experience, you can access more and more elements of that by adding more entries to the structure and also remove them one by one if you like to do so. So about syntax, what do you need to do in order to introduce such a structure? Well, you just have to use these open and closing curly brackets, which will, in this case, create an empty table. You could also put initial values in there in key value pairs separated by, I think it's a comma or something, but we'll see a few of these examples later on. But the most basic thing is an empty table, which is just these two curly brackets. So how do you access the components of such a table? Well, you can create new entries with the square brackets. So in this case, you would create an entry with a value of roughly pi at the key 42. So we get a kind of a key value interface to the whole thing if we use this these square brackets. So k has been 42 before, and that's the value of k, so 42 will be the key for accessing the whole thing. We can also access with other data types. We can also use strings, for example, or even Boolean or whatever. We can use that for indexing in the whole thing, and this will create new keys, in that case, the string. Well, what you can also do is you can remove entries from there, and you do that by assigning nil to the particular key, and after that it will act either as if there would not be a key, or a key of k, or as if the value stored in there is just nil. So it's a little bit hard to say what you will actually see, but that's a little bit independent, implementation dependent, what is happening in the background. Yeah. Also, there is another thing, which is an operator like this small dot, a full stop, and that is kind of a syntactic sugar, and that's just rewritten internally into the version that explicitly indexes with the thing that you have provided at the right hand side of the string of the full stop as a string key to the table. So that is just syntactic sugar, but makes the whole thing look like a structure like we know it from something like C. So you can imitate that kind of feeling if you like to do so and want to get rid of all these square brackets and little things here. So that's what we're going to see later on a little bit. What's the life cycle of such a thing? Well, you create it as a reference and reference it from a variable name. You access it like that. You can perform an assignment to some other variable. and it will do assignment via reference. So it will just create another reference to the same thing. So if you now access the key in K within this B and store something in there, that will change what A full stop K will actually evaluate to, since B and A refer to the same table and the key views is actually the same. So looks quite different, still does the same, these two paths here. You can also just make A refer to something else, in this case nil. You remove the valid reference to the original table from A, and still B will be pointing or referring to the same table. So it's just ordinary reference variables that you have here, reference semantics. And only if you overwrite the reference in B with nil, you will somehow kill that, of course. You have killed B, and there's no reference to the original structure anymore, and your implementation might decide to somehow throw the table away. Depends on how lazy or how sophisticated your actual implementation is, whether it performs something like garbage collection. Yeah, so far nothing special. It's just structures, you could even say it's just hash tables baked into the language, and the rest is some kind of dynamically typed basic C statements that you can use here. So, a little bit of specialities going on here. With the tables, you can somehow alter the behavior of your tables in there. Especially what is used in that case is these so-called metatables. What is a metatable? A metatable is, as the name implies, it's from a type point of view, it's just a table within the memory system of your Lua program, and it is used as a kind of lookup table that collects special functions that are associated with a particular meaning. This association works over naming conventions. So if you assign a special function under a special particular key in this meta table, then you can use this meta table and attach it to some other table. So you somehow bring them together. You do that with the help of a special system function, which is this set meta table thing. And by doing so, you register this meta table thing as a lookup hash table for in case that something special happens to the table that you have attached it to. Concretely, if you use an arbitrary table and use it as an operand to, for example, a plus operator, with a simple type, you will perform something like an addition. If you end up with a complex type, which is a table in there, the system won't know what to do with that. But there is this facility that is called the meta table, and if you have registered a meta table for your table that acts as an operand, this will be used to look up under the key of this underscore underscore add and use that function that is registered there as a callback for call to that with the original function for which you have registered that meta table as parameter, so that you can have your user provided code executed at there. So that is something pretty similar to what you get with this operator overloading thing in C++. So as an example, let's create such a situation. We start off with an empty table. This table is intended to be used later on as a meta table. That means as a registry for callbacks that are associated with certain situations in which another table can get into. We will intend that to be used as a meta table later on for another table, which is this one over here. This is my actual table that I'm going to use as data carrier or as a structure later on. And I want to use that in, for example, in additions or in multiplications or in concatenations with strings or whatever. But in order to be able to use that in a meaningful way, I need another table to act as a carrier for callbacks for these situations. So I want to attach this other table via this set meta table thing. So that will put our original table, this meta thing, as meta table for my other table A. For that to make any sense, we still need to somehow provide such a callback. And we can do so by registering a function under a specific key. And that's what you see happening over here in that area. We see there's a function definition, and we define a function as meta point underscore underscore to string. Remember, this meta point is just another way of saying meta square bracket open and as key this thing. So that is just writing to the key underscore underscore to string in table meta. And what it is writing is the complete this reference to this function here. So we register this function under the key underscore underscore to string in table meta with that expression here. And what we register here is a function that takes a parameter and returns a string. And the string that it returns is, well, it performs lookups in the parameter for the key prefix and the key name. So far, if we haven't seen the part over here, if that is not visible now for us, so let's make it very, very black. It just doesn't make any sense so far. We have a parameter, and we look up keys that we haven't defined yet. But that's the magic of dynamic typing. We will trust the system that as soon as we have put everything together, it will work. Hopefully. So later on, if we look at the things that that are happening over there, the structure that we introduce, that's actually carrying our data, now of course obtains the keys or the key value bindings that we desire to have. So in our structure we have a prefix, which is this, of course, the doctor, and then there's the key name, which has the actual name. So it's always nice to make fun of old colleagues, so I've put these things in there. But now we have these attributes in there, and we already established that we will use meta as the meta table for A. And now the thing is the following. Here, I use A as a context for print. Print will internally try to make a string out of everything that it gets. And that is a situation that is covered with a callback in Lua. And what it will do is it will explicitly look for either if it is a simple type, then it internally knows what to do in order to bring that to be a string. If it is not a simple type, then it will consider the meta table of the table that it is presented here for the to string callback and call it with the actual table that it has gotten. So the A will go in there and to string will be called with A as a parameter. So the prefix here will bind to this one and the name will bind to this one. So in the end, we will obtain the string that is created here and everything will be fine. Yeah, same thing will happen for when we use the object as an operand for an addition, for a subtraction, for division, for concatenation with a string, for a whole lot of other things, and these are the operators or comparators that are predefined for that. Also, of course, the toString thing, and you can register callbacks for that in your meta table. So far, I think if you have ever heard from a concept like this operator overloading, you're quite familiar with what happens. Here, it's just the mechanisms that are behind that. Registering this meta table thing looks a little bit strange at the first place. But there's a reason for that, because it doesn't stop with just simple operators and type conversions. There's also the concept of delegation realized with these meta tables. And delegation is a concept that is realized with a specific key. It's this underscore underscore index key, and that is going to be important whenever in a lookup of some name in the original table for which this table is a meta table failed. So in case a lookup failed, we won't get nil automatically anymore if you register something in index, but instead we will have a callback and have a chance to provide something different to nil. And that gives us a chance to delegate a lookup from one table to another, for example, or to some other constant or whatever value you want to give back. But in general, what you get here is this a means to delegate from one object to the next, and possibly if there's also such a mechanism installed to the next, to the next, to the next, and so on. So we can have full chains of delegation here. How does that look like in practice? Well, let's extend the example that we already had. So it's still the table meta that we're going to use as the meta table somehow, and then there's this person table that we want to attach that meta table to later on. And right now, what we have already seen is this toString method that's still acting the same way as it has done before. What's new here is the index entry, and index entry is once again a function. But this time, what it works on is two parameters, and they're intended to be used as the table on which the original lookup has failed and the key under which the lookup has failed. So it gets you the original situation on which the lookup has failed, and you can react to that. The key idea in delegation is now to react in a certain manner, and the manner is you delegate the lookup from the original table to another table. And the way that it does that in our case is it will delegate to another table, which it assumes to be present under the entry prototype. So it will perform a lookup of the key prototype, assume that what it gets back of that is another table, and perform a lookup of the key on that table. So you delegate this lookup to a member of that thing. So you see that how that works in the example over here, where we have such a structure where there's a table job. This table job is referred to by the entry prototype in our person. And that's the general situation. You have the registering of meta as the meta table for the person. And now we perform the print of the person. That will propagate to meta tables to string entry because, yeah, you need to convert to the string. In there, we will have to resolve the reference to name. And luckily, we have a name in there. It's Simon. Very well. Now we need to complete the whole expression. Thus, we have to also resolve a person's prefix. But in contrast to the example before, we don't have an entry of a prefix in the person anymore. We have decided to restructure our data structures a little bit more in more deeper, and we have introduced this job thing, which now carries the prefix. So in order to resolve something like the prefix, we install in this index thing this table.prototype, which will be resolved in the way that, well, the person will go into the table. The prefix thing will be the key to look up. So the person will make it over here. So we will first look for the prototype key in the table person, which we can resolve with job. So that will go in there. And on this thing now, we will resolve the lookup of key, which is prefix. So we look in job.prefix, which is this thing. Yeah, tedious, but in the end, we come to a meaningful value for that. So it will be Dr. Simon, as it is appropriate. So that's delegation. That looks a little bit enormous for just such a little bit of functionality, but we'll see how that will be facilitated after this slide, I think. Just to give you an understanding of what actually happens in memory, I've painted a kind of a representation of the tables here in a graphical manner. So we start off with a person's representation. This has a key value pair with name Simon, and a key value pair with prototype and job, while job itself is another table which carries a name value pair of prefix and doctor. And after we have registered this set meta table things, what we have added to the system is, of course, the meta table, which is this thing over here, which carries name value pairs. Oh, that's a Okay. So, which carries this toString and index method, and internally works, of course, in the same way. There's also kind of a hidden name value pair which you can't access apart from using this set metatable, get metatable facilities. But internally, it works like just expected. You have name value pair, and this refers to the metatable. So these functions that are referred to, I have kind of invented some creative addresses that are dangling around in the system, but they're of course meant to be these implementations over here. And this encodes the redirection or the delegation, and this will mean that we will just query in person for the prototype thing, which would delegate over here, where we can then look up any key that we have missed in the original table. So that looks a little bit complicated, I've said. That's because index does not necessarily need to be a function. A function is only if you, well, you can of course use a function if you want to actually perform something quite sophisticated and complicated and longer than just a simple look up in another table. If you just want to delegate to another table, you can just put the table into the meta table as value for that key. That makes the whole thing look a little bit more easy. So we have the meta. We have the meta table as we have had it before. We have the person as we have had it before, and our delegation target over here. And toString remains the same. Just the __ index will not be a function anymore, but instead we will see it as just an assignment of the delegation target table to the index slot within the meta table. So it suffices to just put the reference to the delegation target in there, and everything works as intended, which will change the memory to look like that. Okay, so that's already a lot easier. At least the code, I think the memory structures that you create with that is, of course, a lot of chaining there. But anyway, so that is what delegation is like in Lua, at least in from the point of view of looking up values. Of course, there's also ways of dealing with situations where you actually want to write to an index that you haven't filled before with something. That would ordinarily just yield an error, but you can register a callback for these situations, which would be associated with the keyword new index. So that is kind of like index, but it is used in situations where delegation with a purpose to write fails, not with a purpose to read. So you can do a lot of creative things with that. But for example, you can do something like access protection in here. So once again, we create our meta table. We create a table that we associate with the meta table later on via this set meta table. And we want to take care that we can't create arbitrary key value pairs in there afterwards when we pass the reference somewhere else, but we want to keep a few keywords reserved, so to say, or somehow protected. We can do that by some kind of indirection. What we choose to do in our case is that we decide to keep the actual data which we communicate to the outside world of that structure in another kind of protected environment, which is this data thing. And in case that we now decide to somehow manipulate the person, there's in case that an index hasn't been there before, we will run into the situation that the new index will be considered, will be called in the system whenever the index hasn't been there before. In that case, of course, as it is a write access to a key, we will not only get the table and the key, but of course also the value that has been tried to insert into the system. And in our case, we register a little bit more complex thing here, where we decide based on what value or how the key looked like, and some other thing in this case, whether or how a certain other key in the original table evaluates, whether we either store the desired value into our internal data thing, or whether we decide to just bail out with an error. So we can do all kinds of funky things in there. And how it will work like would be, for example, like here, where we would in the end try to somehow write to our data structure. And if we use this first key name and put the actual value in here, that will later on trigger the condition to actually be passable, and then try to introduce the new field of the key title, and we fill it with exactly the data thing against which we check over here. We will just refuse to manipulate our internal data structure. Only if we do something else, that will be fine. So that's one way of doing creative callbacks in Lua. Okay. And imagine that is all just with simple statements and just one principle that we have here, which is just hash tables and a little bit of syntactic sugar. So now that we have established what the basic means actually are that we have in our language, let's have a look at concepts that we have gotten to know from other languages, and that was this idea of having several instances of similar behavior, and that is the thing that we called objects before. So far we haven't seen anything like that. We just have seen these tables, which of course can be passed around, and references of those can be passed around, but we haven't really seen some way of somehow sharing properties between them. And that's what what you will see on the slides over here is now an approach of kind of simulating the ideas of there, and you can kind of introduce these mechanisms that you see here step by step into your program until you're satisfied with the functionality that you need for implementing your problem. So. Yeah, of course, what you can implement, which is already quite similar to the interface that you used from objects is you can introduce names that have things that look like attributes but are internally these key value pairs. And if you introduce something like that, you will be able to access them in a way which is pretty similar to, or looks similar to, the way that you act with objects. And yeah, you can also specify methods or something which is pretty similar to methods, and it's just like the way that you have seen before. You just register a function under a certain key in a hash table, and then that's already pretty similar to a method call. In principle, it looks pretty much like that. But so far, this has no concept of different identities of objects. So there's just one account out there. There's not several of them. So we don't differentiate between the accounts with the code that we see so far. That is mainly due to one thing: the reference to the original table over here. So the idea would be now to somehow get rid of this common collection of key-value tables, and use a common scheme of accessing and provide several of these things. How does that look like? Well, in difference to before, we don't specifically access the account by name anymore, but instead we introduce one degree of indirection via introducing another parameter and using that in order to look up the names that we consider to be well-known. And of course, we also have to carry that into the string method. And with that, we can already try to start working. We consider account now as the carrier of functionality for other tables, which then act as the instances of the whole thing. And the idea is to have in the instances only the attributes that are the entities that keep each object unique, and share the functions between those instances. And the idea would be to have the system delegate from the instances to the to this registry where we have all our function templates. And in order to achieve that, we register all the methods that we are interested in within account, like that, and use account as the delegation target in a meta table. And as we don't want to introduce too many new names, we just reuse the table account also as the meta table, which will delegate to, in this case, itself. But we don't want to create too many new tables in this case, so that's why we do it that way. So in order to create new instances of that thing, which can be kept apart from the original account, we now just create tables that only have the attributes that we need. So in this case, what we access is the balance. So this new thing, zero, which will be some kind of account, will have a balance key-value pair with balance is zero. And we set as a meta table for zero the account table. So a count table has special entries for certain situations where we cannot resolve lookups in Giro, and it will dispatch to, well, it will dispatch to itself, to account. So all the method names that won't be found will first of all run through this underscore index indirection, and then in the end will be resolved in the account thing. What that means is, of course, that we can now, instead of doing an explicit account withdraw on Giro with the amount of 10, we can instead use Giro withdraw, which will try to resolve the withdraw thing within Giro. Giro doesn't have a withdraw thing, but it has a meta table associated, which is account, and it can look in account's index where to resolve withdraw, which will lead to account, and account can resolve withdraw. This line is so central in the idea of Lua that Lua has introduced a syntactic sugar thing for that. And the syntactic sugar for that is this thing. So the idea here is that the mentioning Giro twice for something as common as trying to use a table as kind of the repository of common functionality for another table, and still having to repeat this Giro twice is nonsensical. So they introduced another syntactic sugar thing, which you find over here, where Giro is only given once here, but you get the colon after instead of the full stop, and you only have to mention the 10. This is comparable to what you have already heard with this receiver being the first parameter at some languages and not being mentioned as first parameter. Same thing happening here once again. And you can, without any dangers of getting errors or any semantic differences, you can just replace one by the other. So it's completely the same. It's just syntactic sugar to keep you from sore fingertips. So with that, you will get the call to Giro with withdraw and Giro as the implicit first parameter. And with that, you can also you can now differentiate between account's original balance and the balance you have defined in Giro. Of course, that thing is gonna go at some point because we will just not have any meaningful balance for just a repository of all the access methods for accounts, but we will optimize that away. So in the future, all we will do is just create custom tables with predefined key value pairs and access them in the common way. So that is the memory picture. And you see that we have here the account as delegation target registered, so this points to itself. So that is how objects are kind of implementable in there. And in order to automate that even more, we would need to make sure that we always actually create something that has a key value pair of a balance and some meaningful value, even a meaningful initial value. And for that, the idea is to come up with something like a constructor equivalent thing. There's no thing as an explicit constructor as a language based thing in here, but it's kind of a programming pattern in Lua. So let's have a look at that. So first of all, account, which is the thing that is now supposed to be used as a class representing a table is introduced, and originally it just doesn't carry anything. We could also maybe leave that away, because we will introduce members of that later on with creating these methods anyway. So here we create this account column withdraw, and notice the subtle change to before. We have the colon here now instead of the full stop. Oh, yeah, I know it's a drastic change, but what it means is that now we don't have to explicitly mention the receiver of the whole thing, but we can use the language facilities that provide us with a name for that, which is the self, in contrast to this in other languages. So you see the same concepts arising in different languages, just called differently. But that is something that you buy yourself into as soon as you start using these colons. So these enable the use of self in there. And already it looks quite like object-oriented things, although all of that could just be replaced with the original, more basic versions of writing that down, which could once again be replaced with these square bracket and string things. So all of that is just hash table misuse, what you see here. Or, well, I call it misuse, but yeah, it's just my mouth, filthy mouth. So what we actually want to focus ourselves on this time is the automation of the creation of the tables that are going to be used as objects afterwards. And that is something that we do. We could call it anyway. We could call it create or build object or whatever you would like, in order to facilitate it to all those object orientation aficionados out there. We call them new. And we may even present it with a template for you will know. Well, at that point we don't know what to make out of that, but later on we will see what the parameters actually gonna be used for. And in case that there's nothing given as a template, we will just initialize the whole thing with a balance of zero. So that is that's not so so important here, but there's a special semantic, special syntax for evaluating whether one thing is nil and providing an alternative value for that. And yeah, big deal. But the thing is that we establish that the template now carries a specific attribute. That's this balance of zero. And what else is automated is that self is used as meta table for this template that we have created. We might ask ourselves what is actually self, and then be reminded that that is once again one of these fancy new column-based methods. So that is actually the same thing as account. So we will use account as the meta table for our newly created template. We will, those lines, I think, could even go outside of this constructor-like thing, because if it's established once, it will remain there. So doesn't have to be in the constructor. But in the end, what we return is this new template. So with that, we create a lot of new instances that all carry a balance in there, pre-initialized with something meaningful, and install account as the meta table for that. And with that, we can create new accounts. In this case, we even have the chance to pre-initialize the attribute with 10, but wouldn't necessarily have to be so. We could also blacken out that thing. We don't have to use that. We can just create an empty new call, and which will create a Jira with a balance of zero, like that. And we can call that several times and get several instances of the thing. So with that, we have already simulated something pretty similar to object so far. The question is now, object orientation doesn't stop with creating lots of instances and sharing functionality via classes. It also is about inheritance. And inheritance is just another way of how to dispatch your calls. And calls are all performed via lookups in our thing. We don't need to be type safe, so there is no things that we have to keep in mind in order to assure that visibility of certain things is there. We just need to be sure that at runtime we will actually be able to resolve a certain name. How it is resolved is determined by the actual delegation. So, long story short, how do we inherit in our setting? Well, we can use something like the differential description, which is pretty similar to what we have with this extends clauses in languages like Java or this C++ based inheritance formulations, where we just provide everything that's new and for everything old we just refer to the predecessor in inheritance hierarchy. And yeah, that can be realized like this. For example, we could determine that we would like to have a limited account. That's an account that, instead of a balance, also carries a configurable limit with itself. And we can pass this into the account creator and obtain a new table that carries the balance and the limit and dispatches to accounts methods for all our purposes. And now we can configure that to keep to our new conventions, like our limited account wants to have certain constraints on withdrawing, keeping to the limit, for example. So what we need to do is we need to make sure that withdraw actually checks a few things before it dispatches to its original. So what we do is we create a new function withdraw based on limited account. And in that case, we can first of all provide a certain filter code and only access accounts original withdraw in case that our filter hasn't matched. That is a possible way to do that. And what I haven't provided here is the actual new for the limited account. This would be the place that kind of automates the thing. I should have put a few dots in there because there's a few things missing. So this thing needs to be automated over here. Maybe move away with all that. That thing is, of course, handcrafted. I need to create a constructor similar to accounts constructor that performs that in a mass usable way and dispatches to limited account first before it actually tries to dispatch to the accounts methods. But in principle, if I do that and create a limited account accounts new, I can use special Jira and withdraw with 90 and probably that was assumed to be kind of continuous, but yeah, that seems to be the Jira from the page before. That's just here for demonstration purposes, that the Jira is untouched by the limited account, of course, but in general, what we would see here is that withdraw that tries to keep to the limit via the method over here, because the withdraw that is actually called will be this one here, because the special Jira comes from limited accounts new and is wired into the whole thing in a similar way than the new from before. I think I should have put the new code on there, but maybe that's something to do in the tutorial instead. But you can imagine the same procedure as we have had before for that. Of course, you don't need to constrain yourself artificially. with just this very ordinary inheritance, you can perform all what you want in your Lua code, in the sense that you can also configure the way that you actually want to delegate. And you can do so because you can register your particular dispatching method in the index field of your meta table. So you could, for example, also dispatch not only to one class but to several classes in case that one of them is not able to answer your dispatching try. So let's have a look at how that looks like. You would, of course, have to use a specific create function similar to this this new function for the other things that would, and this create class thing is kind of a method that glues together the classes parent 1 and parent 2 and returns a new class that then has a new method that is able to create create instances that dispatch to both parents in case that you can't resolve one of your lookups locally. So, how does that do that? Well, you of course once again need to provide the future class as a table. First of all, it's empty, but then you register your meta table in there, which is kind of an inline version here. So I've used just this this squiggly brackets here, and it just has one purpose here, and that is providing a very special indexing function, which is for delegation, if you remember. And it uses the version that has two parameters, the original table on which the lookup has failed and the key for which the lookup has failed. And what it does is it just takes the references to the tables from parent 1 and parent 2 and uses them to carry out the lookup for the keys that couldn't be found so far. And if the first one is not possible, then it will or does not find an entry under the key, then we will just return parent 2's answer to that query. So easy is multiple inheritance in Lua. It's just a customized dispatching function and references to parent 1 and parent 2. Of course, it's a little bit exaggerated here. If you do it like that, you will have a deep search in all the parents of parent 1 before you even try to look for parent 2's things. And yeah, it's a certain kind of linearization, but well, at least it has two parents, and you could, of course, do something you could do something more complex in here than just this switch based on whether you find anything or not. You could do some kind of linearization and then perform something on there, or you could even do something like a symmetric dispatch on there, where you just answer with a value in case that you find one of them either not saying anything or both of them agreeing on a certain answer. You can do everything you want here. You can even implement traits or mixins or whatever you would like in these kinds of dispatching functions. Anyway, that will be then the meta table for this C thing. While C itself is intended to be the carrier of functions that are specific for the child of this multiple inheritance thing, so that one also needs to act as a delegation target. That's why we register that with this __ index in itself, and then attach it to some object O later on within the constructor facility. So we have once again one of these new things in there, which is added as a function to our class C, or well, our table that acts as class for instances. And with this new thing, we can then create instances of this C thing, which is a child of both parent 1 and parent 2. And yeah, so this child class then is the thing that we return here to the user, and the user can then use the new method to create instances of that thing. So it's kind of multi-layered what we do here. It has three layers, with the parents, with the child class, and the actual instances of that thing. Okay. That's an application example of that. So you can kind of create the class researching doctor from the classes doctor and researcher, and that class then is just the carrier for the constructor new for instances of the class researching doctor, and you can provide it with certain attributes, and we will create you an instance of researching doctor, which will then carry all those key value pairs that we have in the parents. Of course, that is just a very special case. It's just dual inheritance, and you can even, with other language features that we didn't have so far, like the ellipses, you can create even multiple inheritance with any number of parents, but that's just tedious work on slides. It just lengthens the slides and doesn't provide any new insights, I would say. A few words on the implementation of Lua. Well, it doesn't say too much in the specification of Lua how you have to implement that, but you could do so by having a few lines of C. It's just, well, you can implement a Lua compiler and runtime system quite easily, and that's probably why a lot of these configurable software projects have done so. So it's a nice kind of well, not configuration language, but you can do nice plugins in Lua by offering an API of function calls callable from Lua and an interpreter for arbitrary Lua code that a user provides, and just have your system be remote controlled from these Lua things. So that's one thing how you could quite quickly and easily implement an engine for something like a game engine, where you just script your events or something. That's a typical use for that. You can implement it quite easily with, you would introduce your the objects that you have as with a code for a type ID and a value, with a value being a union of whatever type might occur within a Lua program, which would be, for example, some kind of number, character, or a reference to some kind of table, which is just a void pointer. So that would be typical values in your your Lua program, and the tables would be implemented as hash maps. In case that you have an optimizing runtime system, you could also try to find out whether your tables are only accessed via numerical indexes, and if that is the case, indices, then you would implement it as an array, for example. And but that's just a runtime optimization. So you can put all kinds of brain into that. A few other topics that we haven't covered here is things like coroutines for some kind of threading in there. There's closures, which we haven't talked too much about. There's some kind of bytecode and VM technology in some of the Lua implementations that we haven't talked about. But for the purpose of the lecture here, we wanted to have Lua as an example for how you could share code and manage your objects and with delegation, and that is the aspect that I think we have covered here quite intensively. So, lessons learned. What can you take away from the Lua talk here? With you can have quite a quick development when you do away with these fixed inheritance schemes and just tinker your constructs that you actually want to use and want to have in your language by yourself. It also leads to horrible runtime errors if you expect something to be there which isn't, and I think it's probably quite the mess to debug. But it's rapid prototyping. That's it for you. Object orientation and multiple inheritance can be seen as special cases of delegation. You can use delegation to implement that. Other approaches to that can be seen as kind of optimizations of these simple delegation processes. It's just tedious to have all these name lookups and hash tables, but in principle you can implement all of these phenomenons as hash table lookups and writes. Yeah. What you also can take away is that with such a minimal feature set and only having these few syntactical sugary things in there, you can already create systems that are quite potent in the sense that you can have all these nice object-oriented features in there, or at least things that look like object orientation have a lot of table lookups under the hood. But in principle, it already suffices to have a minimal feature set, and software projects that have only minimal features that you have to implement have the property that you can do that in just little time, and you can try to get it as correct as possible with the time that you have for getting your work done. So it's always nice to have these small compact engines that drive everything. And yeah, considering that a lot of these projects out there have Lua plugin possibilities, you see that other people have also realized that you can implement those things quite easily and profit from a very potent language. I think who has these Lua things is, these GIMP plugins, for example, are Lua. Then you have LaTeX dialects that feature Lua. What else is Lua? There's a lot of these projects out there, but yeah. So it's quite easy to implement and to attach to your own library of functionality. And also, when I talk about these horrible runtime errors, you can of course try to circumvent that by performing a whole load of static analysis ahead in order to try to find bugs ahead of time. So you can have helper tools that try to facilitate your work with that. And I think, I'm not sure about the Lua side, but I think the JavaScript side, for example, has a lot of those tools that already try to correct your code. And also a few of the people who have learned from JavaScript have come up with new languages that are still quite similar in the sense that they have these delegation things, but try to make things more easy to analyze in order to keep you from writing horribly runtime buggy code. So, yeah, there's a lot of things that you can do on this code. So there's a lot of opportunities to shine with static analysis. Like, yeah, I don't know whether any of you have been in the program analysis or programming optimization lecture parallelly. Well, that's exactly where you learn about approaches to do static analysis. Anyway, if you're more interested in Lua, you can have a look at the further reading part here. Apart from that, I think I'm done for today, and expect you to work a lot on many questions on the topics of the last semester. With these words, I think, wish you a good day, and thank you for listening.